The Cooper Heart Institute supports WHYY. Their multidisciplinary team of cardiologists introduces the new Watchman device, a minimally invasive treatment option designed to reduce the need for long-term blood thinners in patients with non-valvular atrial fibrillation, thereby reducing the risk of AFib-related stroke. The Cooper Heart Institute is a comprehensive heart care center with offices throughout South Jersey. Details at cooperhealth.org/watchman.
It's July 6th, and there's still no budget deal in Harrisburg. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. So, who will be the first groups to suffer from a lack of state funding? Well, that'll probably be those who get services from nonprofits, many of which get money from the state. Many cater primarily to poor and underserved residents. And joining us now is Carrie Parnes, CEO of Philadelphia Mental Health Center. Carrie, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Now, the Wolf administration no longer has the authority to pay social service providers. And does that include your organization? And what percent of your monies come from the state?
Most of our monies come from the state. I'm going to say about 80%, but not directly. We live on the services that we provide and the billing that we do. So we live on what comes through the door. And those state monies are managed by CBH in Philadelphia and by Magellan in the surrounding counties, in Bucks County and Montgomery County and Delaware County. So the issue would be that when we bill for Medicaid services, which are funded by the state, if that funding is not delivered to the Medicaid HMOs, they eventually won't have the money to pay us.
What are the range of services and clients that your organization serves?
We serve children with more intensive behavioral health needs. We specialize in autism, and we serve children and their families. So at any given time, we have about 1,000 clients. Some of them have more resources than others. Many, many are very underserved and live in a great deal of poverty and with a lot of difficulty. So the services are very, very important.
To what extent was this impasse anticipated?
To some extent, we learned to live with this. This is certainly not the first time, and it probably won't be the last. The last time this happened, it was resolved within a month or so, and it didn't have much impact. The time before that, when this happened, CBH in Philadelphia was forced to start paying partial money on services delivered.
And did that entail staffing or service cuts?
For my agency, for Philadelphia Mental Health Center, it didn't, because we work really hard to anticipate not the specifics of this situation, but to know that monies are going to come and go. We have to work on a really tight budget and be very, very careful. But many smaller agencies that may not be able to have the savings behind them or to have the resources or even to have the vision to survive in the nonprofit world simply closed the last time this happened, and it went beyond 90 days.
You cited the center's focus on autism-related services, though I imagine if this impasse continues, would it be important to prioritize being able to continue to offer services for those in acute need?
We'd have a hard time drawing those lines between which children were more needy than other children. We also deal with children who are bipolar, schizophrenic, very high-level ADHD, children with lots and lots of different kinds of needs. And how do you say to a family, I'm sorry, I know the state has said you're entitled to services, and I know the insurance says they're going to cover you, and I know that we've put you under psychiatric and psychological care, and we have a therapist going out to your house, and we have family therapy going on, but we're going to stop that because we're not getting paid. It's not ethical. We can't do that. And that's the problem for the behavioral health agencies, that we really, if this goes on too long, we become trapped in the middle. I mean, what are we going to do? Are we going to say, I'm sorry, our bills weren't paid, so we can't pay our staff, so we can't be there for your child who has a prescription for service? A prescription for service at this level of intense mental health need is like a prescription for an antibiotic. So if we only have the money to buy 3 pills out of a round of 10 for antibiotic treatment, should we just give the child 3?
That would not be effective.
There's no point. There's really no point. We really need to continue the course of treatment.
Carrie, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you very much for talking with me tonight.
Carrie Parnes is CEO of Philadelphia Mental Health Center. If you think the Pennsylvania state government is embarrassing, look north to Maine. As Chris Cetullo notes in this week's Center Square commentary, some remarkable things are going down east.
Up in Maine, they have a governor who's been able to pull off a rare feat. Paul LePage has united the usually quarrelsome Republican and Democratic caucuses of the state legislature. Hold the applause, though. Maine's harmony across the aisle hinges on this point. Everyone pretty much agrees their state's head honcho is out of control, embarrassing, and in need of investigation. In a unanimous vote, a legislative committee agreed to initiate a probe into allegations that LePage strong-armed a charter school into rescinding the hiring of a Democratic lawmaker. It should be a short probe, since LePage unapologetically says that's exactly what he did. LePage, a former discount chain owner, has been a rolling tempest during his time in office. And by the way, last week he endorsed Chris Christie's presidential bid, Birds of a Feather. Some of the turmoil stems from LePage's blustery, impulsive nature, but some derives from his fondness for a flawed analogy. Maine's governor loves to say he's just running the state the way he ran his chain of retail stores. Run government just like a business. This is a sacred cliche of Republican rhetoric. Here, let me hasten to add that some Democrats have their own pet fallacy, that government should be run as a protective guild for its employees. But the idea that government is the same as a business is just not true. When an imperious corporate CEO like LePage takes over a government and doesn't adjust his behavior, what ensues are gridlock, service breakdowns, and talk of impeachment. Government is emphatically not just like a business. Governments exist to provide public goods to people living in a defined swath of geography. Businesses exist to provide profits to those who own them. In a business, the shareholders and the customers are distinct groups. In government, they are one and the same. A person who founds a business can run it however he pleases, within the law. No government CEO enjoys similar free rein. They must compromise. The men who founded our nation, a few steps from where I'm standing, made sure of that. Yes, having one person call the shots can be efficient. But the patriots of Independence Hall had had their fill of such efficiency. Their word for it was tyranny. So they designed their new government to be inefficient, precisely to prevent someone with a great man complex from running roughshod. Paul LePage is a man of the Tea Party, but he needs to bone up on his Revolutionary War history. I'm Chris Cetullo.
Chris Cetullo is WHYY's Vice President for News and Civic Dialogue. Residents of Delran, New Jersey, a town of some 16,000, are still coming down from a high. Last night, they rallied around hometown soccer hero Carly Lloyd as she catapulted the U.S. women's team to a World Cup victory over Japan. WHYY's Bobby Allen went to Delran to talk to Lloyd's neighbors.
Francesca Carolla lives two doors down from where Carly Lloyd grew up. She remembers a young Lloyd running up to her house on warm summer afternoons.
Mm-hmm. And she was knocking my door, can I play? Like, you know, in my backyard, because I got a big backyard. And used to play by herself and juggle with the ball. And my husband is Italian, said, one day this girl, she's going to be a famous.
We just always looked up to her, and she used to just school us, you know what I mean, and all the guys and stuff.
That's Saul Carolla. He agrees with his mom. Everyone in Delran knew early on that Lloyd was bound for big things. But he says her rise also represents something else.
It's someone that came from this town, a small town in New Jersey suburbs, a middle-class neighborhood, and made something for herself. And a lot of people think of this day and age, oh, the American dream is over. But she's definitely a prime example of that.
Local bars were packed with Lloyd supporters for the championship matchup. More than 200 people came out to Otto's Tavern in Delran. Bartender Brittany Delaberta says it was more raucous than most Sunday nights.
I mean, everyone was on their toes. Everyone was up and cheering and dancing around and chanting for Carly. It was pretty cool.
While fans around the world were amazed by Lloyd's 3 goals in 15 minutes, Delaberta says no place had more pride for her than Delran. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
Turning to this evening's headlines, a U.S. appeals court upholds a federal plan limiting pollution in the Chesapeake Bay, this despite objections from farmers accusing the Environmental Protection Agency of abusing its power. The EPA says animal waste and fertilizer that move from streams into the Chesapeake, including some in Pennsylvania, are the largest sources of bay pollution. Pennsylvania is among six states that have agreed to the pollution limits. One day after a large wave washed out a Jersey Shore community's 4th of July fireworks display, the wind wreaked havoc. Seaside Heights canceled its display last night for the second consecutive day, this time citing winds exceeding regulatory limitations. Officials have yet to announce a new date for the show. 84 degrees, partly cloudy skies on Independence Mall. It's 6:15. You're listening to Newsworks tonight on WHYY. There's a chance for a shower this evening, then remaining cloudy overnight, low 73 degrees. Tomorrow, partly sunny, humid, a 40% chance of showers or storms, high 88 degrees. For Wednesday, hazy, hot and humid with a 50% chance of precipitation, high 92. Still ahead, one Pennsylvania city is poised to be the first to successfully recover through Commonwealth Act 47 for distressed cities, though others have tried.
One of the things you'll learn from Nanticoke is to follow the plan.
Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY.
Intervention Associates, a subsidiary of Friends Life Care Partners, supports WHYY. A nonprofit, Quaker-based organization, Intervention Associates provides care management and guardianship services for people of all ages. Services include home care, community services, crisis intervention, and patient advocacy. Intervention Associates navigates all available healthcare options and medical benefits. Clients receive a professional needs assessment and detailed care plan. Information at interventionassociates.org.
For Georgia-born musician Mackenzie Scott, better known as Torres, songwriting is an essential part of confronting the past.
The writing is the healing, the sharing is the communication. Not only communication, but forgiveness and all of these things that have to come eventually for peace.
Who's that trying to...
Torres joins us in the studio for an intimate discussion and a performance later on Sound Opinions.
Get more interesting tonight at 10 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Moore College of Art and Design offers career change part-time evening programs for adult men and women at their convenient Center City campus. Students can create new options for their future by earning a professional certificate in interior design, print and web design, motion graphics, fashion design, or fashion merchandising. Now registering for summer courses beginning Monday, July 13th. Further details at moore.edu or 215-965-4030.
Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Nature's fireworks pick up where 4th of July festivities left off. Joining me to paint the picture is Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. And Derek, why don't we start with the limited time offer to spy a brilliant Venus?
Yes, Venus has been absolutely gorgeous in the evening skies this past month, and it's sort of finishing out its visibility through the month of July by showing us all sorts of really wonderful things. First of all, this Friday, we'll be able to see the greatest illuminated portion of the planet as it makes its circuit around the sun.
Now, you say portion of the planet.
Yeah, because it's an interesting thing about Venus. It's difficult to tell unless you're using binoculars or a small telescope. But both Venus and Mercury show us phases like the moon does. And as we look at the portions of the planet that are most easily visible, well, we see that Venus is going to show us its greatest illuminated portion coming this Friday.
For those in need of a visual assist this week, look no further than the Franklin Institute Thursday night.
Yes, this Thursday night, Night Skies at the Observatory starts at 7 p.m., and we'll be observing Venus, Jupiter, and Saturn with our rooftop telescope equipment, so we'll be able to get great views of that.
The night sky is a beautiful canvas, but 2D. What's this about 3D observing?
As most people look into the evening sky, it's very easy to imagine. We're looking at a velvet curtain, a dark velvet curtain, with these pinpoints of light stuck onto the velvet curtain. I mean, this is what the stars tend to look like. But we have this really marvelous opportunity over the next few weeks of viewing those two planets in the western sky after sunset, Venus and Jupiter. Now, if Jupiter is the largest planet in the solar system, for it to appear so small, it must be at a tremendous distance. And indeed it is. And the distance difference between Venus and Jupiter to us is well over 300 million miles. So if we look at these two planets now and think about that space, that gap we see between them instead of being sort of like a horizontal separation, but instead a separation in depth, then we can begin to make the scene of the night sky pop into this three-dimensional nature. Now, there's one other piece to add to that, and that's to think about the platform from which we're observing, and that is the Earth. So the Earth, with its motion around the sun, combined with Venus' motion around the sun, helps to shift our view as one planet overtakes the other. So as we look out into space, let's say we look from Earth directly toward Jupiter, the smaller one of the two. Well, the brighter one, Venus, is actually inside the orbit of the Earth and orbiting the sun faster than we are. So we'll see the separation away from the line of sight between Earth and Jupiter grow over the coming weeks. So we're actually seeing Venus coming around the sun towards us in a sense and then curving back around the sun on its path that's inside the Earth's orbit.
Wow, that perspective and size differential really comes to play, as I imagine, twilight, when you can still see the setting sun and starting to see the points of light. It really gives an appreciation for how big the sun is.
Yeah, there's no question about that. And any kind of question about how the planets, once they all gather together or line up in alignment, any question about their effect on the sun is completely negated when you consider what the incredible difference is between them.
Uh-oh, I can already anticipate the emails from astrology aficionados.
Yes, absolutely. You know, those positions are very important in an astrological sense. But while we could calculate the effect of all that mass on the sun, and yes, we could say that there is an effect, for all intents and purposes, the sun has no idea.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight.
You find Earth boring, just the same old, same thing. Come on, sign up with outer space, ways incorporated.
No Pennsylvania city has ever successfully completed the Commonwealth's Act 47 program for distressed municipalities, though that could change within the next few months if the state stops overseeing the city of Nanticoke's finances. Though Keystone Crossroads' Emily Previty reports the coal region city's financial stability comes with caveats.
Yeah, you have like the lava soap, if you get grease your car or whatever on you, you can rinse off there.
That's Public Works foreman Sean Carey, showing me the place where he and his coworkers wash up, at least as long as he's been here. Before that, the city was so broke that there was no running water in its Public Works building. You know, the place that's headquarters for the people with the grittiest jobs involved in running a city, including routine exposure to dirt, sludge, and chemicals. They were without running water at their home base for more than 3 years.
What did they used to do then?
If it got bad enough, they had uniforms. They'd grab a fresh uniform from the rack, or they'd go home and grab one out of their closet.
Carey's boss, Public Works Director Wally Pavelitz, tells me later other options were a nearby gas station or City Hall half a mile away. Pavelitz says they also kept jugs of water on hand and a first aid kit for emergencies, like someone getting chemicals in their eyes. He says that happens every so often. So there's running water now, but Pavelitz says there are still challenges.
We actually have around 38 miles of road, approximately. And when I first started working in the late 70s, the street department was actually 18 employees. We're down to four, and it's really affected us a lot because our infrastructure took a beating with this past winter. I want to do a lot of hot asphalt patching, but with the crew I got now, it's impossible.
Nanticoke's pretty typical for a Pennsylvania city born of coal mining and stagnant since that industry went bust. Thinning workforce, decaying infrastructure, and declining population. Act 47 coordinator Joe Boyle says those are some of the factors working against places like Nanticoke, and some of the reasons why the programs worked for 9 distressed townships and boroughs, but no cities.
Most of the cities are older, smaller, poorer.
Boyle spoke after a public hearing about Nanticoke possibly being the first city to reach financial stability through Act 47, but it comes at a cost to taxpayers. The city entered the program in 2006 when its long-suffered financial plight hit crisis stage. they'd borrowed money yet again, bringing their loans for day-to-day stuff to $1.7 million, more than a third of its budget at the time. The state agreed to help with no-interest loans and the expertise of Boyle and his colleagues at the Pennsylvania Economy League.
When you've got an ingrained level of services that you provided for the year, typically it's full-time police, full-time fire, public works, code. And if you've been providing that for a level of 30,000, as Nanticoke was, now you're down to 10,000 people, you're still trying to support that level of service. It gets very difficult.
Nanticoke's distress signals included the fact that three-quarters of homeowners paid less than $200 a year in property taxes. That's because their assessed values hadn't been updated since 1965. In Pennsylvania, county tax offices don't have to do updates with any regularity, and state law caps property tax rates for cities like Nanticoke. Once they hit that ceiling, property tax revenue stagnates. Jerry Cross runs the Pennsylvania Economy League's Central Region office. He says when Luzerne County finally reassessed in 2009, it really helped Nanticoke.
There's two restructurings here. One was the county level reassessment. The other one was the home rule charter.
A home rule charter allows higher local taxes, but must be approved by voters. It seems impossible. Get voters to agree to pay higher taxes. But Nanticoke isn't the only place to do that in recent years. There's Altoona, another Act 47 city, and Carlisle, which is not distressed. Boyle says politics does discourage officials elsewhere from even trying for that, like West Hazleton, another Luzerne County community where Boyle oversaw Act 47.
These guys are concerned about their political status, although given everything that exists in the political culture in West Hazleton, I would seriously doubt that home rule would change anything.
State law does require home rule charters to specify a limit on local revenue increases of no more than 10% a year. It's 8% in Nanticoke. The new expenses add up to $563 a year, or 2.5% of median income for a family living in a house assessed at the city median value. The extra cash works out to nearly $3 million additional dollars annually. That's more than half the budget. But the city will still keep raising taxes, at least a little bit, to balance future budgets and save money for emergencies, and have any hope of ever doing some of those badly needing infrastructure projects that it's avoided for so long. Here's City Councilwoman Leslie Baczynski.
It's definitely overwhelming, and I've been a single mom for years. We try very hard not to have any more possible raises, but with the world today and all the increases, a lot of times there's nothing really you can do about it.
So what can other cities learn?
One of the things you'll learn from Nanticoke is to follow the plan.
Cities don't always do that. Take the city of Chester. Got into Act 47 25 years ago, since started getting $10 million a year from Harrah's Casino, and still cannot balance its budget and continues automatic 4.5% raises every year for City Hall unions. Other lessons from Nanticoke. Counties need to reassess property values more frequently so they're not artificially depressed. And going home rule is a way around the state limits on local taxes. But the bottom line, according to Cross,
the lesson is you don't continue doing business as usual and get out of Act 47.
The thing is, business as usual in Nanticoke meant living there was cheap. It costs more now. And the money is going to stabilize city finances and maintain services, not enhance them for the people paying more, at least not anytime soon. Emily Previty, Keystone Crossroads.
Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media initiative reporting on the challenges facing Pennsylvania cities. WHYY leads the four-station project. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas. Listen again to a story or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online at newsworks.org. New technology is helping some police forces keep bicyclists safe on the road. Could it come to Philly? We'll have more on that on tomorrow's show. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.
The National Museum of American Jewish History supports WHYY and welcomes listeners to Richard Avedon, Family Affairs. The exhibition features more than 70 works by the renowned photographer, including a massive mural of beat poet Allen Ginsberg and his family, a group portrait of Andy Warhol and the factory, a series of portraits published by Rolling Stone on the eve of the 1976 presidential election, and more. Richard Avedon Family Affairs runs now through August 2nd. Details and tickets at nmajh.org.